An interim CEO has all of the problems that the departing CEO has avoided. So now he has this interim period where people don't know whether he's actually going to ever be the boss and don't know whether to suck up to him or not. Mark, hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so now don't mention the weather.
Never mention the weather. Never, never.
But.
Yes.
Spring is sprung.
Right.
And the tides are upon us. Okay.
Yeah, this past week was extraordinary for some absolutely amazing weather on South Africa's coasts. There were really incredible videos going around of people sitting at the Brass Bell in Cape Town, looking demurely into the camera and then just being covered by water. Cars being washed out to sea and all of that sort of stuff. Do you think that we are actually going through a weather crisis around the world, or does it just feel like a crisis because every time there's a weather event of some sort or another, we think, oh my God, that we have a weather crisis?
Well, that's a general sort of in-your-face information discussion, but I think we are. One of the things our country's blessed with is relatively moderate weather crises. We're not in the eye of the storm. We don't have that many floods. We have some droughts. And these spring tides are, they're big waves, but they're not tsunamis. They're not devastating entire villages. They're breaking a few windows in hotels. And of course, there've been some casualties, but it is, the moon is out there. And there's no doubt that the effects of climate change are beginning to manifest.
Yeah.
In fact, a friend of mine on the Brass Bell, I don't know if you saw the waves on the Brass Bell, a varsity friend of mine, you know, when we saw that, we reminisced on the damage that might have been caused in the heydays of the Brass Bell's festivities. That's for sure.
Yes, you can sense that a couple of people were sobered up pretty fast. They have done a kind of tally of insurance is always the best indicator of all of this. $1 billion plus insurance claims consequent from weather events in the US are currently at a record. It does tell you something, I guess.
I'm a little curious about insurance and weather. There's this thing called force majeure. And I suppose if you've specifically insured against a specific weather event, then you're covered. But otherwise, I would have thought the ultimate definition of force majeure is weather.
Yes.
The wrath of God, as it were. So I don't know how we can reconcile those two things.
Yeah.
Anyway, let me say this next. It was sunny at the Wanderers Stadium this week. Okay. And I need to retract with regret the statement I made last week about don't mention the cricket.
Right.
Mention it. Okay, we came from 2 down to win the series 3-2 by an overwhelming 122-run victory in the final test at Wanderers. And the best part was looking at the crowd.
All right, let's move on to different topics. Yesterday was a big day for Naspers Prosus.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm fascinated by this company. It's enormous, somewhere between 15 and 20% of the entire value of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange is vested Koos Becker's recognition of the potential value of the Chinese company Tencent way back then is still the best investment that anyone has ever made, ever.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
Perhaps not, we don't know, but pretty close, one would imagine. Anyway, they lost their CEO yesterday, right? And he left immediately. So now, I just wondered about that. You've been a CEO. You've hired CEOs.
Yeah.
You've never fired a CEO, I would presume. You would never do that.
Can't say. Yeah.
But what do you think about the process of immediate departure once you've been booted?
First of all, let me agree with you. When Naspers sneezes, the JSE catches a cold. Okay, so it's a big deal. I come down on the side as where you want to go or where they want you to go today. There's absolutely no value in staying there. The handover of these things in a properly functional organization is all in place. There's an informed executive that knows these things, and I do not subscribe to joint CEOs or interim CEOs or acting positions. Make the damn decision and get on with it. Certainty has got more value than messing about with alternatives. So if you want to go today, go.
Yeah, you know, I see the value of that. I mean, just in the journalism industry, one of the interesting rules that Bloomberg, the international data and news provider, very dominant now in financial markets, they have a rule that if you resign, you leave that day and you never come back. That's the other thing. Is once you've resigned from the organization, you are never offered a job in that organization again. It seems kind of hard-assed, quite frankly. The one problem I have with the idea of the immediate departure of the CEO is that in Naspers' case, they now have an interim CEO, Irvin Tu, a very interesting person, just by the way. But he now has to sit for a while as...
Purgatory.
Yeah, yeah. One of the consequences of the CEO leaving immediately is the interim CEO has all of the problems that the departing CEO has avoided. So now he has this sort of interim period where people don't know whether he's actually going to ever be the boss and don't know whether to suck up to him or not.
Yeah, okay. I think that's also indicative of a flawed process in the sense that everyone should kind of know who the next CEO is going to be if it's from the internal resources, or else you should be clear, make it clear that this guy is not the CEO. He's holding the rudder whilst a search will now commence for the other. So there should be that kind of certainty as well, I would have thought, yeah.
All right, that's interesting. The other news of the week, I don't know if it was really the kind of news of the week, but it certainly caught my eye, was the presentation of a bill in Parliament called the National State Enterprises Bill. This is the biggest reorganization of state-owned enterprises in more than 20 years. It basically, the idea of the bill is to try and prevent political meddling, is to put all of the state enterprises into a single company, which vests in the presidency, and then that will be at least a little bit of an arm's length away from the kind of political process. That's the idea. What do you make of this?
I can find no logical justification for it. Okay. Just to give a vague view on the matter.
Very specific about it.
You can't make one apple better by throwing a whole lot of bad apples into one basket. Okay, the way to cure a mixture of good and bad apples is to remove the bad apples, okay, from the system, not clump them all together. And so I think this thing, whilst in a positive sense, it could have all sorts of capital raising momentum and economies of scale and central savings and all of those things, I doubt those are going to emerge. And if indeed it's there to just gather them together, it's going to cover a multitude of individual sins. And it's not going to be able for us to discern between the goodies and the baddies. And I think that capital should be, in the first instance, sought to be raised SOE by SOE, not backed by the government, to see what the relative costs of capital are and to be able to decide and make decisions based on the entity. This holding company stuff, it's a bit like an investment holding company on the stock market. Always trades at a discount to the sum of its parts, okay? I don't even get this debate about whether this has anything to do with meddling. On the contrary, I would have thought if you've now got one boss and that's in the presidency, first of all, where is the qualification to have such a multidisciplinary understanding of all of these businesses that they should rest in one place or one person? And second of all, what's stopping them from intervening? They're still the sole shareholder. So I don't get it, and maybe I don't understand it, but I don't get it at all.
The interesting thing is, to me, that there's a body within the presidency that's been looking at this issue, and they've looked at international examples. They've come up with three examples, but I think two are the interesting ones. One is the Chinese state-owned enterprise entity, equivalent of the Department of Public Enterprises, and the other one is the Singaporean one. And you know what's so weird about this is that the Chinese one, right, this is a communist government, right?
A communist democracy, mind you.
Almost all of the Chinese state-owned enterprises have a big chunk of private investors in them. Between 20 and 50% of the ownership of the companies lies in private hands. And the Chinese like this system because they argue, and I think they're right, you know, that it creates a different set of incentives. It creates a different incentive system to a wholly state-owned sort of enterprise. So now, by contrast, the Singaporean example is exactly the opposite. So Singapore, the bastion of free market capitalism, their state-owned enterprises entity is wholly owned by the state and is huge, by the way, and has over 500 companies in it.
Yeah.
So basically, and it vests in the presidency. This is basically the model, the structural model that they're thinking about. But the point is that the Singaporean entity is really a private equity company, which is operating on behalf of the state. And that's different to an enterprise for national champions, which is, I think, what the South Africans have in mind.
Yeah, we're trying to get a hybrid going, it seems to me. And I think increasingly, the notion of private investors coming in is becoming more acceptable, if not necessary, to redeem the failing SOEs. And it's exactly what you said. Have we got private equity expertise at the head of this basket of SOEs? That's the test. Not the structure isn't the test. The competence and the appropriateness of the mix is the test, okay? And they've got 500, we've got 700 SOEs, okay? Some of them are tiny, but it's not about structure. It's about the different capital equations and the role of the state and things of that nature. Structure must submit to the strategy, not the other way around. I'd be surprised if it makes any difference. They've been talking about breaking Eskom up into three for the last, since I can remember, but I suppose in Eskom, anything's just a number. I think they throw dice to decide what stage we're in because, hell, we went from like stage six to stage zero to stage one to stage, I don't know. Okay. It's anyone's guess over there. I'm not a supporter.
No, I mean, I do have sympathy with the idea of a restructuring of the state-owned enterprises department. After this is done, apparently, the department will disappear, which seems like a plus. In most cases, you would think of it as a plus because it just reduces the costs a bit. But there is a sort of negative aspect for it. The state-owned enterprises department, the Department of Public Enterprises, existed in apartheid times, and then it just stayed. It just hung on.
Yeah.
And the reason it hung on was because the idea was that it would become a department which launches these state-owned enterprises out into quasi-private ownership or total private ownership, depending on what they were and what they did. And then all of a sudden, the government got incredibly cold feet about the idea of investment, of private investment in these companies. And that was a terrible decision because at that point, Eskom was just flying and they could have raised a mountain of money if they had put it partly in private hands, like the Chinese have done.
Yeah.
So the department has lost its function, but it could go back to that function of being the agent of a more rational public-private interaction when it comes to state-owned enterprises.
It might be a cost-saving to have the department disappear, but what we're not looking to eliminate departments. We're looking to skill up departments. We're looking for competence. We're looking for experience. We're looking for airmanship in order to fly this thing called SA Inc.
Right.
So I think that thing goes to the heart of the remuneration models and the drivers of decision-making. There's no outcome-based remuneration model in government. No wonder you can't attract them from the private sector. And the capital equation is borderline insoluble. In fact, at the moment, what I see the government doing to raise money, we've talked at length about the crisis in Treasury and in our balance sheet. And now what's happening is the government's forcing municipal revaluations and petrol price hikes. And for that matter, the price of gas and the NERSA debate and all of these sort of regulated prices are then our tool of choice. It's not economic growth or funding SMMEs or anything. It's like, what can we extract per force? And the solution to the grants debate is finding itself argued about as a percentage of VAT, not as a cure for the structural impediments to the social debate. And so I think what we need to start off with is not look for a model in a different set of circumstances to ours, but deeply examine our own circumstances, skill up, capital up, and let's solve our own problem with skill and expertise. That's what we need.
Yep, yep. I agree. I mean, it's interesting that some of the government tax levels in municipalities, they're now enormous. I'm astounded at what middle-class people are being asked to pay.
Yeah.
For a very substandard set of services in cities across South Africa. And that's just because the cities are disintegrating. So in acts of desperation, the municipal managers are using the tools at their disposal to try and buy their way out of the problems. And actually, in a sort of strange way, they're making it worse because it just encourages capital flight or encourages people to move to semigrate or semigrate, to move to these controlled townships and stuff like that. It's self-defeating.
We now have fires every now and again, it seems to me. I see there was one at the civic center and they evacuated the speaker and the mayor and whoever else they regarded as being important. And then we have these pronouncements on water restrictions for do not water your garden. I subscribe to those. We all need to save water when it's scarce. But what's the root cause of the water shortage? Not watering your garden. It's leaks, manifest huge leaks of gushing water in a decaying infrastructure. You know, it's not my hose that's causing the problem. It's a gateway of water the size of my flat. No, man, we need to look inwards and try and have a long... The trouble is there's no time, okay, or there's no perceived time. So we're not looking for long-term cures. We're not looking for long-term expertise and skills. We're looking for immediate politically popular solutions to much deeper problems than we've got in view of an election next year. And who knows which way that's going to go. Just get out there and vote. I've got some numbers, Tim.
Hit me.
Okay, so my number of the week, I'm going to ask you a question for a change.
Okay.
How many egg-laying hens do you think we have in South Africa?
I don't know how many, but I know it's an extraordinary number. Just an extraordinary number.
There's 29 million laying hens in our country. Okay, that's the same as half of the total human population of our country. And now there's been some bird flu about.
Right.
And so they have to cull the entire surrounding birds when one bird's got bird flu. And so we've culled 3.5 million of those so far because of bird flu. And the cost of eggs and the shortage of eggs is going to materially go. Eggs are a big deal. You can't have bacon and eggs without eggs. Okay?
No, that is true. That's so wise.
Yeah, it's true. And here's the irony. One of the principal purposes of eggs is the incubation of the influenza vaccine.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow.
And so it's bird flu that's causing a shortage of eggs, which is causing a shortage of incubation capacity for influenza.
Right.
There's a couple of things you didn't know. Huh? Yeah. So that's my number. Beat it.
Okay, right. Here goes. Here's a very simple question that you'll know right off the bat, right?
Yeah, here we go.
Which is the best country in the world?
South Africa. I've got a passport to defend you. Okay.
Some of these polls and stuff, they're so weird. And, you know, I don't know where they get their numbers from. Anyway, the magazine US News and World Report does a ranking each year of all of the countries in the world and comes up with the answer to the question, which is the best country in the world?
And it is
Switzerland.
Yeah, yeah, you know, they've got the chocolate already.
Okay. Here's the interesting thing, right? They've been doing this for years and years now.
Yeah.
Australia, although they're not doing great in sport, they've now just overtaken for the first time the US as a,
yay,
you know, as the best country in the world. So they are now the fourth best country in the world, according to this. And the US is fifth, Canada is second, and Sweden is third.
There's a strange, it seems to me, correlation between getting ranked in the top of the best countries in the world and the extent of control of the population, okay? And the extent of the rules and the nanny and police state characteristics of some of the place. I mean, I want a bit more adventure, man. I want to be able to live in a place where we can have a go. That's why we live here. This is the most adventurous country in the world, let's face it.
Which is why we live here.
And then events of the day, I read that someone stole a crane. Okay, like a massive crane that needs an abnormal load truck to move it from A to B in Secunda. Thumbuck walked in and stole it. Okay, I mean, I'm sorry. It's not like you can put it in your pocket or sneak it out. Okay, so we are now grand theft at a grand scale.
And very adventurous.
Very adventurous. That's who we are.
And a very adventurous act. Stupid, but adventurous.
Adventurous.
Cool, Mark.
Okay.
Look after yourself. Thanks for the chat.
You too, my friend. Cheers.
This show is part of the Africa Podcast Network.
The biggest pod network on the continent.
For sales inquiries, please contact us at info@africapodcastnetwork.com.